Welcome to Booking the Territory, a pro wrestling podcast hosted by Mike Mills and Doc Turner. This podcast is all about what's going on in the world of professional wrestling. And now, here's your host, Mike Mills.
Welcome back, wrestling fans, and I hope you enjoyed our recent episodes on Booking the Territory with Big Daddy Yum Yum Byron Wilcott. By now, you should have had a chance to listen to parts 1 and 2 of my conversation with Big Daddy Yum Yum, and I'm probably betting you found part 2 pretty darn interesting. And just wait, if you thought part 2 was interesting, wait till you hear part 3 when he gets into the whole situation with Bill DeMott. It is very, very, very interesting, and something that, as a wrestling fan, I'm sure you'll want to hear, given all the stuff that's going on with Bill DeMott and him no longer being in the developmental with WWE up in NXT. So very interesting stuff there. But the reason we're here, you may notice that we have a second podcast this week, and normally we only do one a week, but in this situation we ended up doing two, and that's because it is July 4th. What happened was I was able to get in touch with the Patriot Del Wilkes from the WWF in the late 90s after he was just on the Stone Cold Steve Austin Unleashed podcast earlier, or I should say last week. Del was kind enough to spend some time with me on the Booking the Territory podcast and gave me about 45 minutes of his time, and I greatly appreciate it. So I figured, hey, let's do something special for July 4th and give you a second podcast with Del the Patriot Wilkes, of all people. So it was a very interesting discussion. One of the things I wanted to do was I did want to do things differently. I didn't want to just rehash the things that he talked about with Stone Cold, because, hey, who wants to hear that again? So we talk about a few different things, and we talk about his time with the Global Wrestling Federation at the Dallas Sportatorium in the early 90s. He talks a little bit about his college football career, which he did talk a little bit about with Stone Cold, but we went into a little bit more with that. He's a huge college football fan, and he sits there with like his coach's clicker when he rewinds and fast forwards his DVR every Saturday when he watches his South Carolina Gamecocks. So he was a real cool guy, and I really enjoyed spending some time with him. The cool thing was, even after we finished recording, Del talked to me for a few minutes, and just a very interesting character. I really enjoyed the conversation that we had. So without further ado, we'll get to that interview, but in 1 second, right after I give a little bit of love to our sponsor, that is TNA's Wrestling Palace. They are your one-stop shop for all of your wrestling memorabilia needs. They are located in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at Traders Village. You can reach them at 682-561-6966 by telephone. That's if you're not in DFW, because the thing is, I've spoken to the owner, and he says he will be more than glad to ship anywhere in the world, and he's already done so. So they have wrestling memorabilia things such as replica belts, you know, the T-shirts, toys for kids, figures, wrestling rings, you name it, they have it. One-stop shop for all your wrestling memorabilia needs. And like I said, please support them, because they always support us. All right, like I said, if you haven't already caught the episodes with Big Daddy Yum Yum Byron Wilcott, you might want to go back and catch parts 1 and 2. Next week we'll have part 3, but as of now, I'm going to get to my conversation with Del the Patriot Wilkes, who I just want to say, if he's listening to this again, Mr. Wilkes, I really appreciate your time, and it was great to catch up to you. So without further ado, let's get to that conversation.
Hello, Booking the Territory fans. I am honored today to be speaking to the one and only Del Wilkes, the Patriot. Most of you probably remember him from the late 90s in WWF at the time, which is now WWE. Mr. Wilkes, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm fantastic. It's an honor to talk to you. It really is. I'm so glad you responded to my message and were willing to just share some of your time with me. You know, I watched you in the late 90s. I watched you in the early 90s in Global, and I was like, wow, he's doing podcasts. I definitely got to get in touch with him and get him on the show. And when I heard about your Kickstarter program for the documentary, I said, hey, that's another thing I'd love to help out with. So we're going to put that on our Facebook page, and on I've already tweeted it on Twitter a couple of times, and looking forward to hopefully we can help you out with that as well from our listeners. As a matter of fact, before we get started, do you want to tell our listeners about your Kickstarter program and the Man Behind the Mask documentary that you're working on?
Sure, I'd love to. I sometime last year, maybe summer of last year, I was approached through Facebook by a guy named Michael Elliott and Elbow Productions. And I'd never met Michael, wasn't familiar with Michael or the work that he does, but he asked me if I would be willing to maybe sit down with him and have him do a documentary on my life, not only my wrestling, football, but my life altogether from beginning to end. And he sent me some clips and some of the other things he's done. He's done similar type work for Ivan Koloff. He did one on Jimmy Valiant, the Rock and Roll Express, Magnum TA. And the guy does phenomenal work. I mean, he's just so good at what he does. And it's not what he does for a living. He has a full-time job where he's a cameraman for a TV station out of Charlotte, North Carolina. And he does this as a labor of love, as a wrestling fan. And he told me here recently that his wife told him that if he spent another dime of their money doing this, that she was going to kill him and kick him out of the house. So we then started the Kickstarter program. Okay. And again, I was unfamiliar with Kickstarter, but what it's done is it has allowed wrestling fans to help us finish this project. And they can go to Kickstarter.com. And it's Dale the Patriot Wilkes, the man behind the mask, and they can donate to help us as we draw near the completion of this product, and pretty soon we'll have it out in DVD. And as wrestling fans always do, they've responded tremendously. And when you get to Kickstarter.com, you'll see it, the different levels that you can donate and what prizes and gifts come with those levels of donation. And we've had a tremendous response so far, and we think we've got a great story to tell. Like I said, it covers my entire life from beginning to present day, the good times, the bad times, the successes, the failures. And even though we have got to the point where we have reached the initial level that we wanted to get as far as donations are concerned, we want people to still continue to go to Kickstarter and donate, because what it's going to do is allow us to quite possibly, if we can raise enough, have a third disc included in this. And so instead of it being a two-disc set, it'll be a three-disc set, and we can tell the story the right way, the way that it needs to be told, the proper way, and can do so in a very thorough manner. So we're excited about it. We're proud of what we've got. And we just appreciate all the people that have supported and donated, and ask them to continue to go to Kickstarter and help us out.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to put your direct link on Kickstarter, the project that it's under, with Dell the Patriot Wilkes, the man behind the mask. And just to reiterate what Mr. Wilkes just said, there's different pledge amounts. I mean, you can give whatever you want, but the great thing that I noticed about it was you're not just pledging. Like, for example, if you pledge – looking at the $15 one, you get an 8x10 autograph from you, plus that fan's name will be in the rolling credits. And, I mean, it goes all the way up to much higher amounts. But what I liked about it was, you know, you have all these different packages. So not only do you pledge, but the fan in return, not only, you know, they're pledging to it, but you even have packages where, depending on what they give, they'll even get the DVD set as well. So it's kind of, when I see that, it's a win-win, because not only are they donating to make it happen, but they're getting something in return, not, you know, whether it's the DVDs or whether it's even the autograph, whatever it is. It just it definitely, as a fan, it's like, man, it's even more incentive. Not only do I want to give to make his make the documentary a good one, but on top of that, I can get all this great stuff just by giving. So it would take me an hour to run through all the different pledges, but there's tons of them. So make sure you go check out that Kickstarter.com page, and trust me, you won't regret it. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I apologize for interrupting, but one other thing I do want to say, even though we have initially we set out to hopefully that we could get $3,500 in donations, and we've done that, but we can still add to this thing and make it better, like I said, with the continuing of the fans donating and pledging. that will allow us to add a third disc. And there are some other people who have played a huge role in my wrestling career that now that we have been able to surpass that mark, now that we can reach out to them now and include them in it, because it costs money to travel to go see Stan Hansen, who's in this. It costs money to travel to go see Marcus Bagwell, who's in this. So even though we've reached the $3,500 level, we encourage the fans to continue to go to Kickstarter and donate so we can have some other great superstars a part of this. It will make it a great product, even a better product.
Absolutely, absolutely. So make sure y'all check that out. And at the time that this interview hits my podcast and on iTunes and on Podbean, I will definitely make sure the link is up on the page. That way you can go directly to it and find it. So, but it's on Kickstarter. It's real easy to find. And to those who are listening to this and have not heard by now, I'll let you tell them you're on Twitter, but you just got on Twitter a couple weeks ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have. I've not been a part of social media. Probably 2.5 years ago, I sent my first text. About 6 months ago, I went from a flip phone to an iPhone, and so now I do have a Twitter account, due in large part to the encouragement from Michael Elliott and Austin. Both of them just stressed to me the importance of, when you're doing a project like this, of being able to reach out to the fans and communicate with the fans, and no better way to do it than Twitter, and it's at Del Wilkes.
That's at DelWilkes, and he's on there. And what I've noticed, you're also very interactive with the folks who tweet you as much as you can. So that's a great thing. So just make sure you check out his Twitter page as well, and then we'll put down the and we'll also put the Kickstarter link up on our page. So I wanted to get that out the way to make sure we got that squared away, because that was one of the main reasons why I wanted to bring you on. And so the other thing is, as we get into this, you know, I know a lot about your wrestling career just from what I've read and listening to the podcast you did with Stone Cold, which was phenomenal. I listened to it twice because I just was – your story and your redemption, it speaks a lot, because if people see that you can overcome, hey, maybe it'll help the next person out that may be going through some trying times. So – that's definitely one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on to reaffirm that. And so I wanted to ask you, you mentioned briefly on his podcast about being from, you know, playing for South Carolina and being a football guy. So do you still follow the sport of college football?
Oh, absolutely. I love football, period. I love all types of sports. But as you very well know, being from the South, there's nothing like college football, and I love following Gamecock football. It goes all the way back to my earliest memories. My dad's father helped develop and cultivate in me a love of everything Gamecock. Two of my dad's brothers graduated from the University of South Carolina. So as far back as I can remember, I would sit with my uncles and my granddad, and they would tell me stories of great players from the past, great teams from the past, special moments in games. And so when it come time for me to decide where I was going to go to school and play football, it was a pretty easy decision. I'm a hometown boy from Columbia, South Carolina, and yeah, I follow. Now, I don't go to many of the games in person. While it's fun, it's a great atmosphere, I prefer to be at home. When I watch football, I watch football, and I don't want to be interrupted. I don't want some drunk guy 3 rows down from me yelling and screaming and cussing at the kids. I want to be able to replay a play, and I watch the offensive line. I'm an old offensive lineman, so I zero in on the offensive line. But, yeah, I follow from the privacy of my home.
I don't blame you, actually, because while going to games is fun sometimes, it's – when you're sitting in your living room, there's no better seat in the house.
That's right.
There's no better way of watching it. And like you said, if you need to pause it or you need to rewind it, and on a DVR, it's so much easier. So, I'm right there with you. I'm a huge football fan. Absolutely, just because I feel like the NFL has just gotten Rod and I talk about this sometimes. I don't know what Commissioner Goodell is doing and whatnot with just various things. And I find myself actually more attracted to college now, whereas years ago I was much more attracted to the National Football League. But I'm a big LSU fan, as I told you before we started recording. So, and just so you know, we play each other this year. So who knows what happens in that one, LSU and
yeah.
South Carolina. So
we do, and I'm looking forward to it. And you know, back to your point about watching it from the privacy of your home, with the ability now to DVR things. My wife accuses me of being a coach. I literally, not only do I watch the game while the game's going on, but it's DVR'd. I go back Monday, and it's like I'm breaking film down. And
yeah.
I'll have her in there with me, and I'll say, "You see where the center? You see where he stepped? You see the guard's first step right there? You see his hand placement? That's all wrong. His face mask should have been right in the middle of the guy's breastplate." So yeah, I mean, I'm fanatical. I break it down and watch it three or four times before the next game on the following Saturday.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's just goes to show you, once a football player, always a football player. You did it enough as a player. So you're watching all the little intricate parts as they move. And I bet you find oftentimes when an announcer will call something, he's not really seeing it right. You're like, no, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He didn't even see a play correctly. So, yeah, it's interesting. Once an offensive lineman, always one. And hey, I found it funny when so I remember I'm a big New Orleans Saints fan, and I told you that's where I'm from. And so you blocked for George Rogers. That was that caught my attention when you said that.
Yeah, I did. I was very fortunate that in 1980, my freshman year, that was George's senior year, and I came in as a true freshman and was a backup. Guard to a guy who was a senior and was a very good mm-hmm. football player. And about midway through the season, he just had a reoccurring nagging injury that was giving him some problems. So as a result of that, there were times when he couldn't play, and I was able to go out there and be in the huddle with George and block for George. And I'm going to tell you, there's what great memories to be able to tell people that you played for the Heisman Trophy winner, be able to block for a Heisman Trophy winner, and to just be a part of that entire process of, in 1980, just watching a guy who was a tremendous football player, one of the greatest running backs in college football history, but more importantly, a great guy, a guy that entire team loved. And George always made sure that his offensive line got the attention and got the praise, and it was always focusing on them, not George. So it was a pleasure to have him as a teammate, to be able to block for him, and to still to this day be a close friend of George's. He's still very involved in the community here in Columbia, South Carolina, and with the athletic department. But very special memories of blocking for a Heisman Trophy winner.
I don't remember him there, but I definitely remember him when he was drafted by the Saints, and the years that he played with New Orleans. He went to a terrible team, and he still let's just say he still made his mark. Now they ended up getting rid of him, but I mean, he was amazing. He was something to watch when I was a kid. So
I definitely
appreciate his talent.
Got a funny story for you. You know, when George was drafted by the Saints, he was the first player taken in the draft that year.
Right.
And he set a record for rookie. I think he had close to 1,700 yards that year, which was a record that stood for a long time for a rookie in the NFL. But Bum Phillips was the head coach in New Orleans at the time. And the conditioning drill that the players had to do when they reported to camp was run a mile and a half. And George didn't make it. I think he fell out at about a mile. So the media naturally were, you know, they wanted to know what Bum had to say about that, what Bum's thought process was. And Coach Phillips, what did you think about your running back not being able to make the mile and a half run? He said, "Well, I learned a very valuable lesson today." He said, "When it's third and a mile and a half, I won't give him the football." And I thought that was a good point.
No, that is funny. Yeah, no, that is funny. And as you were telling me that, I was looking it up. Yeah, he you're exactly right. 1,674 yards. He led the league in rushing in that rookie season. So that's pretty darn good for a rookie in the NFL. And keep in mind, he went to a team that was terrible and still put up those kind of numbers.
Sure did.
They were not a New Orleans Saints for a long time were not a good franchise. Well, I had a couple other questions. I'm glad I got to talk to you about a little bit of football because I'm like I said, I'm still a huge fan. So I have either read or heard when you left. I don't remember you in the AWA, mainly because I know they were on ESPN, but I just don't remember if I was watching at that point in time. And I remember when you were in Global, and I thought I heard a story that you came there as the trooper. But you didn't know until the first show that you were going to be the Patriot the first time you were in Global. Is that correct, or is that an inaccuracy that I read?
No, that's accurate. They
Okay.
this Global thing had been there had been talk about it for a long time, and supposedly there was this extremely rich man from Nigeria who was going to dump, tens of millions of dollars into the company. We knew that we were going to get that time spot on ESPN that the AWA had, which was Monday through Friday from 4 to 5 o'clock. And
Right.
it never materialized. This, I don't know if he was a myth. I don't know if it was a guy that actually existed, but this Nigerian with tens of millions of dollars never dumped that kind of money into Global, but they did find other investors. And so I was contacted by Joe Pedicino and Bill Eadie, who were booking at the time and in charge of talent. And I flew out to Dallas for the very first TV taping ever for Global. And I took my trooper gear because that's who I was working at the time. I'd just come from the AWA working as a
Right.
trooper. So I figured that's how they were going to use me. And we all stayed at the same hotel. And literally about 3 hours before we went to the sportatorium to film our first show, Joe and Bill called me and asked me if I would walk across the parking lot to Joe's room, his hotel room. And I did. And when I got in, they said, "Look, we've got an idea for a character that we think will just absolutely make you a star. And we think that it's good timing for it." This was back around 1990 when Saddam Hussein had gone into Kuwait and had occupied Kuwait, and President Bush had sent our military into Kuwait to liberate Kuwait and drive out the Iraqi military. So patriotism was at a high level, and
Yeah, I remember that.
they said we think we can take advantage of the high level of patriotism right now, and we've got an idea for you called the Patriot. And they literally had the costume box sitting there, and they opened it up and they pulled out a red, white, and blue mask and a red, white, and blue set of tights and red, white, and blue trunks to go over those tights and a red, white, and blue vest. And they said, "What do you think? Are you willing to do it?" And I said, "Absolutely, sign me up, I'm in." And that night was the first time anybody had ever seen that character. And when I walked down the aisle to go to the ring there at the Sportatorium, that building erupted. I mean, that place went crazy, and it's giving me goosebumps now just telling me about it. And I knew then, and I think they knew then, that we were on to something good and something that had just tremendous potential.
Yeah, that play. I've talked to Rod Price has told me on numerous occasions how special that building was, and I could see in that environment in Dallas, Texas, during that time frame. Because I remember when all that happened with Saddam Hussein in the early 1990s. I'll call it the first Gulf War, I guess, if you want to call it that. Yeah, patriotism was at a all. I was in high school at that time, and patriotism was at an all-time high. I specifically remember that. So I can see the Dallas hotbed wrestling scene, even though it was the 1990s, post WCCW World Class. It was still hot. I could see how that building and the wrestling fans there would just go nuts over that, and they would erupt from it. So That's an interesting story. That was one of the main questions I wanted to ask. I actually was a listener question, and I kind of researched, and I was like, I wonder if it's true. So, interesting, very interesting. That did happen.
That was I had heard an awful lot about the sportatorium myself. I was looking forward to actually working in that building for the first time, and you know, not only was it famous for wrestling, but you know, Elvis performed there in the late 50s, and so many big time stars in country music, George Jones, and countless others. And it just blew me away the first time we pulled up to the building, and here's this old wood frame building, and you know, it's not what I was expecting. You get inside, and there's no air conditioning. There's just these big exhaust fans up top to try to keep the place cool. And it wasn't very big, not very large seating capacity, but the fans were right on top of you. And what an unbelievable atmosphere for wrestling. Just great memories about working that building.
Yeah, a couple of things as you're describing it. So I've almost read all of James Beard's book, The Third Man, and he's supposed to come on the show soon to discuss a little bit about that, but he describes it the same way that you describe it. And like I said, I've talked to Rod Price a million times, and he's always described it just as a magical place. I also met the late Tommy Rogers, who just passed away a few weeks ago. I met him years ago in the mid to late 90s, and I remember him telling stories about it. And everybody that you ever talk to will talk about how hot it was in the summer and how cold it was in the winter, but it was just a magical place with a, you know, just a magical aura to it. And I pulled up to it once before they tore it down, and I remember thinking to myself, keep in mind, I'm born in 1975, so I grew up watching World Class on TV, and all I ever remember is hearing the world-famous Sportatorium. So, and then as an adult, when I pull up to the building and see it, I'm going, that's the World Class Sportatorium? But,
you know,
so yeah, yep, I know what you mean.
There are some buildings and there are some venues that I'm fortunate. There's one in my hometown of Columbia, South Carolina, where I saw my very first match live when I was 10 years old, and it's called the Township Auditorium. And in some ways, it's like the Sportatorium. It's an extremely old building now. It did have air conditioning, but it was small. The fans were right on top of you. The acoustics were phenomenal. So 3,000 people could sound like 30,000 people. And, you know, you didn't have to have a large seating capacity for a building to have that electricity and just that unbelievable air of excitement in it. And the Sportatorium and the Township are two of the buildings that are like that. Just great, great. Of course, the Sportatorium is no longer around, but just great wrestling venues.
Mm-hmm. You know, you ever hear that term when they say less is more?
Absolutely.
Well, those buildings were less, but you know, for their time, they were more.
Yeah.
The proof was in the pudding. I mean, those places were packed and just magical. So. No, thank you for sharing that story about your time there, because everyone you talk to says it. It was just a magical place.
It was.
Magical place. So I got a question. Do you even watch any wrestling today at all?
I do. I don't watch a lot. For one thing, there's no one left that still works that was working when I worked. I guess Taker does his annual appearance at WrestleMania. I guess Rock occasionally does an appearance and will get in the ring and work. So from that end of it, I've lost a little bit of interest. And I admire the guys and the girls that are in the business today, because I know the type of hard work and dedication and sacrifice that it takes to be successful at that level. But I'm just not a big fan of the product today. And that's got nothing to do with those that go out night after night and take bumps and do what they do. It's those that are in charge that dictate the angles and the storylines and the themes, and just not a big fan of that. But I do occasionally watch. I can't tell you the last time I sat down and watched an entire show. It's been years. But on Monday night, I may catch 10, 15, 20 minutes, and that's probably about it.
I hear you. It makes sense. Like you said, you respect everything the guys and girls do. They get out there, they work their hearts out, they get on the road, they do their thing, and they put forth the tremendous effort. It's one of the things a buddy of mine, we talk about, is the time commitment it takes nowadays. When I was growing up, shows were 1 hour, and Ring of Honor is 1 hour now. But to sit down and watch Raw for 3 hours, it's just the time commitment it takes. It can be difficult at times. So, and then, like you said, product-wise, it's just a lot different than when you were doing it. It's a totally different ball game.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot more adult oriented, but still it's focused at children. And I'll never forget the night, and it was a Monday. It was a TV night, and I was on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I said I couldn't remember the city, but they had a fan that called in and said it was Richmond, Virginia. But it was the night that Vince called a meeting with all the talent and all the bookers and all the agents. And he said, look, he said, we're getting ready to change the way business is done in our industry. We're going to blur the lines. We're going to push the envelope. It's always been the good guys wore white cowboy hats and the black guys wore the black cowboy hats or the black boots and the black trunks. And we're going to change that now. And what was good is going to be bad, and what was bad is going to be good, and it's going to get more adult-oriented. The language is going to change, and the content is going to change. And they did just that. And so it's led to the current product that we have. And I guess a lot of us old-timers, so to speak, probably feel the same way. But appreciate everything that the talent does and the sacrifices they make, just not that crazy about the product.
Yeah. Well, and you lived it, how hard of a business it is being on the road and, being gone a lot and the bumps. And, I mean, you talked about your injuries. I've heard, all about your injuries on Steve Austin's show. And I remember when you talked about your tricep. When I met Tommy Rogers in like 1998, his triceps had these huge bulges on the back. And there was a guy in the back talking to him. He goes, man, how do your triceps look like that? He goes, oh, you got to tear them. Well, evidently, his triceps had torn. I don't know if he never – I wish he's not alive for me to ask him, but his triceps were bulged up, like up on his arm. You described yours kind of like a shade that had just rolled up. That's how his triceps looked at that point. So when you said that, I was like, wow, yeah, that had to hurt, tearing a tricep like that. That had to be pretty brutal. And that's what these guys, the injuries and whatnot and things like that. Now, medicine's a lot more advanced now than it was, even 15, 20 years ago. But still, you get these bumps and bruises. These guys and girls, they go out there and they do a hard job. And to the point you make, yeah, it's a rough business, so you respect what they do. It's just you're just not crazy about the product. And I can understand that, how you feel that way.
Yeah, and I had the same, and I fought an awful lot of Tommy. Tommy was a true professional and loved the business and went out every night and just put his heart and soul into it. But I had, and of course, it was the injury that eventually led to me having to retire. But on numerous occasions, I literally just ripped the tendon off the bone, and the tricep just rolls up the back of your arm. And it's very painful. You have really very little ability to extend your arm. It affects not only what you do in the ring, but, you think of about when you're in the gym bench pressing or doing inclines. Well, a certain amount of that is chest, but there's an awful lot of tricep that goes into that. And when your triceps are detached from the bone, it then affects your ability to train properly, to work out properly, then in turn, your physique starts changing. And so that was, the process I went through as I was dealing with these torn triceps and trying to work around them or work through them and overcome them. And eventually it just got to the point where, the thing that I had depended on the most to make a living for me my body could no longer do it, and I had no choice but to retire.
Yeah, it's hard because I mean, at that point, as far as your age goes, you weren't. It wasn't like you were, you know, old. It wasn't like it's just that your body was starting to break down on you. Thus, you were like forced to retire. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I attribute a lot, and I go into greater detail in the documentary, The Man Behind the Mask, Dale the Patriot Wilkes, that while probably the most enjoyable years of my career were spent working in Japan for All Japan mm-hmm. Pro Wrestling and working for Mr. Uh-huh. Baba, it was a much more physical style of work. And as a result of that, it took a toll on my body and shortened my career.
Yeah, you know, back then I never saw any of the stuff from Japan. I've seen it since then. Like I've seen the you know, different things on YouTube, and then now on Access TV, there's they show the New Japan stuff now. It's a year old, but they show it, and it's completely different now. Just the whole style, the physicality is just tremendously different than you would see pretty much anywhere else. But it's I'm amazed at the style. I go, goodness. I mean, they just get at it. I mean, the physicalness and the toughness of it is unreal. It's a pleasure to watch because it's an hour long show, and you know, you can sit down for an hour and go through a match, and you'll be done in no time. By the time you get through the commercials, it's 45 minutes, but it's tremendous. And to see, you know, to know, hey, you know, you were working a similar style like that back then, I could see how that would tear your body down. And then you, for a bigger guy, you weren't one to stay on the ground. I mean, I've seen some of the stuff you used to do. For somebody your size back then, that was unheard of. I don't say unheard of, but, you know, a 275, 280-pound guy to do what you were doing, the drop kicks and coming off the top rope. You know, a lot of big guys your size, they didn't do all that stuff.
No, they didn't. And I was always – fortunate that I was blessed with athletic ability and was a pretty doggone good athlete. And so
definitely,
those things looked good coming from a big guy. And I got a piece of advice one night from an iconic figure in Japan, Stan Hansen. Stan is without question the most popular American that ever worked in Japan. And I mean, he was Elvis Presley-like in his popularity. And he pulled me aside one night. It was actually my first tour working for Baba as the Patriot. And I had gone and worked one tour as the Trooper. And I had done that Patriot missile off the top turnbuckle, and I'd done a drop kick off the top turnbuckle. And Stan pulled me aside one night, and he said, hey, he said, look, man, he said, that stuff looks good. He said, it's impressive. He said, and the people like seeing it because you're such a big guy and you can do that. He said, but I'm going to tell you now, the more you do it, the more they're going to want to see it. And he said, it's going to shorten your career. He said, you need a finish that's easy on the body. Stan had the lariat. Rashke had the claw. Wahoo had the chop. Dusty had the elbow. He said, those guys don't have to leave their feet with their finish. He said, your finish is jumping up on that top turnbuckle and diving halfway across the ring. And he said, your elbows and your knees won't be able to take that for very long. And that went in one ear and out the other. And I wish I would have listened to Stan and taken Stan's advice on that. It probably could have added a few more years to my career, but I didn't listen. And therefore came the tricep problems and the knee problems that, you know, that ended my career.
It's still impressive. I was, before we talked, I went on YouTube to look at some of your old stuff because it had been a while since I had seen you. And I mean, even to this day, to see you come off the ropes at the size you were from the top rope, I mean, you know, and I'm used to seeing some of these guys nowadays. I mean, they're doing moonsaults, you know, guys your size. They're doing things that they're flying around like they're cruiserweights. But, you know, even today, the stuff that you did back then, it's still impressive. I mean, it's like, this is a big guy. I mean, I don't think people realize that your height, you were, what, 285? And I'm talking solid, you know, muscle. We're not talking 285 and much flab there. We're talking 285 and a low body percentage, correct?
Yeah, I was
low body fat percentage. I mean,
yeah, usually between 285 and 290. Yeah,
yeah,
pretty doggone lean.
You were very lean. It's just very, very impressive to see somebody that size, because at that time people just weren't doing those things. I got one other listener question for you, and I kind of agree with this individual, because I was a huge Bret fan growing up, a huge Bret Hart fan, and this listener wants to know, what was it like when you came into WWE, WWF at the time, working with Bret Hart? Because I think that was kind of what you first came into, right, when you went there?
It was. That wasn't our plans initially to and when I say our, I mean mine, Vince's, Jim Ross's. It wasn't our plan initially to throw me into that angle with Bret. As a matter of fact, and I go into great detail in the documentary about this, but I had the opportunity before to go to work for Vince back in the early 90s. I'd met with Vince, and it just never worked out. The timing wasn't right for either side. So in the late 90s, when I finally did have the opportunity to go to work for Vince, I signed a three-year deal. And Vince wasn't convinced that at that particular time in wrestling that a masked guy could get over. And, of course, I felt that a masked guy could. Anywhere I had went, I was over with the fans, had tremendous fan support in WCW and Global. So I felt like that could still be the case in the WWF, but I don't think Vince was totally convinced of it until the first few nights. And he saw the crowd reaction when I would walk through the curtain and walk down the aisle, and then decided that it would be a great thing to put me in the program with Bret. Because at that point in time, Bret was on that anti-American campaign, and he had the Hart Foundation. He had Pillman and Owen and Davey Boy and Matt Hart and those guys, and it was a perfect fit. And it was spot on. And I enjoyed working with Bret. Bret was he was serious business in the ring, and I was used to that. I had just come from All Japan, where the work was a little snug, it was a little tight, which I didn't mind. I was perfectly fine with that. And so Bret was working with Bret was a lot like working with the guys I had worked with in Japan. So we transitioned into that very easily and had a good thing going. Just couldn't stay healthy, to see it out and see it to the end.
Yeah. No, that's I can't tell you how big of a Bret Hart fan I was as a kid. And just he always looked so serious, and just he was a smaller guy. He was bigger than me, but one of the things I'm only about 5'8", 5'9", and so guys that were smaller, I kind of leaned towards liking them and wanted to see him succeed. So he was, he wasn't your height, your weight, but everything he seemed to do was, he wanted to be perfect. It seemed so, and I respected that. It looked like he was a hard worker. And so we got that question. I said, man, I was right up the alley, because I was going to kind of ask him about that, how it was to work for Bret, work with him, I should say.
He was a true pro. We talked back about the stuff in All Japan. During my time in All Japan, the two different stints I had there, they did the greatest business they had ever done. It was phenomenal, the business we had. We sold out everywhere we went. We had a phenomenal lineup of talent. But what sold tickets, working for All Japan, what made people watch our TV show was the in-the-ring action. Every match had a clean finish. There were no managers. There were no valets. There were no DQs. There were no countouts. Every match had a 1-2-3 finish. Somebody got their hand raised. There were no interviews on the TV show. It was all about what went on in the ring. And so guys were very serious about their work and their work style. And Bret was like that as well. So, yeah, everything in that ring was serious with Bret. And he was a consummate professional once he stepped inside that ring.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I think it seems like the product nowadays, at least in the States, is suede, where you just explain clean finishes, no interference, no managers, all wrestling. Now you tune into a lot of stuff, and it's just, I don't want to say just the opposite, but it's the pendulum has swung to where it's now you have less in-ring product, lots of interviews, maybe a lot of interference, and it's just a different world, a different landscape, I guess, that's part of it, because there's so many people now who are educated, at least they feel they're educated to what's going on, and things are just so different. There's no, like what you just described, it's like, I think people would like to see that to an extent, but they don't get to, just because of the way it's, I guess, written nowadays, as I'll say.
Well, that's totally well said, and I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Wilkes, that's I really appreciate you coming on. I did not want to keep you. You gave me I got 42 minutes of your time right now, and I'm just so grateful that you gave me some time and were willing to come on my show that I have, and it's really been an honor and a pleasure to talk to you. I was hoping I could get Rod Price on with us, because I know he wanted to talk to you and kind of shoot the bull with you, as he said when I let him know that I had connected with you. But he couldn't join. So, no, thanks again. Thanks so much. So, again, this is the Patriot, Dale Wilkes, and make sure you go to Kickstarter and look up his Kickstarter, Dale the Patriot Wilkes, the Man Behind the Mask documentary, and also look him up on Twitter. He's at Dale Wilkes. He's on there, and he's new to social media, so go give him a couple follows, and he'll tell you more, but definitely make sure you check out the Kickstarter. Do you have anything else before we sign off tonight?
Well, they can also go to Facebook, and I've got a couple of Facebook pages there. One, just Del Wilkes, that's DelWilkes, and then another one, Del the Patriot Wilkes, and on that we'll have dates and of a lot of the events that I'll be at, autograph signings, personal appearances. But I guess the main thing tonight is that Kickstarter campaign, and we appreciate everybody that's donated, everybody that's taken part in this and helped us complete this project. We're looking forward to it. I think it's a great story, and they won't be disappointed. And again, I thank you for having me on and allowing me the opportunity to talk about our project in the DVD. I appreciate it very much.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. That was a very, very, very good discussion that I had with Dale the Patriot Wilkes, and someone that I watched as a kid, and he just was a really, really nice guy. So that being said, man, that's gonna wrap things up for this week. Like I said in the opening, remember, next week is part three of my conversation with Big Daddy Yum Yum, Byron Wilcott, where he pretty much lets loose on the situation and his feelings towards Bill DeMott, the former WWE trainer in NXT. So it was extremely, extremely interesting, so to say. I got a feeling I'm going to get tons of feedback on that one, just because he was so candid about, and he was so honest in his feelings. Now, whether you agree with those feelings or not is another thing. I'm just telling you, you're going to want to listen, because he does not hold anything back, and he unleashes himself on the situation and on his feelings towards the person. You probably may already know how he felt if you are a friend of his on Facebook or on Twitter, because Byron was very, very, very honest on social media about his feelings when he found out that Bill DeMott was no longer with WWE. So you'll definitely want to check that out. As for the meantime, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, or the two episodes this week. So, because of the July 4th special we did with Dell the Patriot Wilkes. So, I enjoyed my conversation with him again, and hopefully you did too. Hey, make sure you check us out on Twitter at @BTT_podcast. That's at @BTT_podcast. My personal Twitter is at @Mike504Saints. That's at @Mike504Saints. And hey, tweet me. I don't care. Whatever you want to talk about. Look, we're always looking for topics to talk about on the show. So if you are one of those people and you like to do fantasy booking, or you just like to talk about wrestling, hey, tweet me. Tweet the BTT inbox, and we'll be glad to discuss your thoughts on the current events or current things that are going on in the world of professional wrestling. So I look forward to hearing from you. Also, don't forget, we're on Facebook. That's on under Booking the Territory. So that'll wrap things up for this week, folks. I will catch you next week. Doc Turner will be back on that episode as we do the weekend review. And we'll have part 3 with Byron Wilcott. Take it easy.